All righty. I want to go ahead and just begin by briefly reviewing, and I'm going to tell you right up front here. I thought it would be a good idea when I was initially preparing the outline to kind of give you a week-by-week idea of what we will be going through and studying, and I completely abandoned that idea. All right, and the main reason is because I have no way of following it. It's really because of me. I know that I don't have any idea how much time we're going to be spending on different parts of it as I'm studying it and going through. I spend a lot of time on parts that I would have thought initially we would just be going right on through. So there is no outline. So secondly, let me just say that I have no intention of making it through the book of Romans in this quarter. All right, I'll just be upfront and honest with you. If we were to do that by the grace of God, which we're going to be talking about, that would be a wonderful thing. But I absolutely have no reason to think I'll be capable of doing that. Because the book is so rich and so full, and I've never gone through it and divided it up and determined how much to spend on each section. So what I'm going to do this morning in just a minute is kind of just give you a general outline in how the book is divided up, how it lays out in regards to how Paul is presenting it. But it has nothing to do with the amount of time that we'll spend on the sections per se. All right, so we kind of ended here last week dealing with Paul's purpose in Romans. And somebody just kind of recap it for us right quick, if you would. Based on the slide that you can't read, obviously. Or just from memory. All right, well then let me recap this for us, all right? Paul has made the point in Romans very, very clear. As we've looked through the book of Acts, Paul is making the case for the doctrinal basis of why man cannot in any way be what? Justified by his works. Or otherwise known as justification through what? Through the law. Okay? Or law. Okay? So there's no way, and you read the book of Acts and you see what's happening in the first century church and the issues that the apostles are dealing with, the New Testament elders, they're being challenged with what it is that makes man right before God. And of course, the Jews have traditionally brought in this false concept, which never was God's plan, that what made one right before God? Keeping the law. And of course, that in their mind is what allowed the Gentiles to be a part of God's saving people or saved people. Because the Gentiles could become proselytes. They could become Jews. They could become proselytes. All right? So, Paul's purpose in this letter is to explain how Gentiles, as Gentiles, and Jews, as Jews, can become one, can become saved, can become justified before God, can become righteous individuals before God from their own perspectives, and how that can actually take place. All right? That's the point that Paul's getting to. And of course, his thesis statement in chapter 1 lays it out, okay? And we'll look at that in just a minute. All right, so here's the general outline, okay? First of all, there's a prologue starting in chapter 1, going through verses 16 and 17, which we've already indicated is his what? It's his thesis. It's the fundamental reason by which he is going to say all the things in the letter following, all right? Paul includes in this his authorship, his statement of authorship, which we'll spend our time this morning hopefully going through. But if you remember, first and foremost, what did we say on Wednesday we were starting today with as far as the text? Doing a little bit of background work on what? All right, on some vocabulary. Typical teacher thing, right? Assign vocabulary words, show up the next time and be able to define them. Well, I'm going to tell you, that's critical to understanding what Paul's getting to. And for us to have an understanding, I think sometimes we just run through all these terms and have an understanding of what they mean, but we're not real clear in how it fits into the text. And we just kind of gloss over it. We just kind of go through it. And then by the time we get to the end of it, we understand the general concepts, but we sometimes, I believe, lose the real emphasis of what Paul is saying because we don't have a deep, committed, convicted understanding of what the terms mean that we're going to look at in just a minute. And he starts in his prologue talking about some of those terms. So his authorship, verses 1 through 6 or 7, his personal remarks through to the church there, to the saints, in verses 8 through 13 or 14. And then 15, 16, and 17, we'll be looking at his thesis statement, really verses 16 and 17. Secondly, we're going to get right after that, Paul's going to go into a very important part of his of this letter. And he's going to address it to both groups individually. All right, the Gentiles and the Jews. And he's going to talk about the impotence of law. Not just of the law, which is what he would have referred to when he spoke to whom? The Jews, but law in general, period. Justification or the inability of law doers to make themselves right on that basis before God. Jews, Gentiles, the entire world is guilty of sin. And he's going to convict very clearly everybody, regardless of what system, cultural system they were living by, he's going to convict them that they stand before their creator, their judge, guilty of sin. Thirdly, there's hope. You're not just condemned. This isn't just a horrific, sad picture that God has left us in this miserable state of lostness. There's hope. There's hope. In what? There's hope in Jesus Christ. How is there hope in Jesus Christ? What? All right. The hope that we have in Jesus Christ is not through some new what? Some new ritual, commandment-keeping system of obedient law keeping. It's not through that. It's the all sufficiency of the grace of God to save lost man. That's his point in chapter 3, verse 21. And of course, right after he introduces it in 3:21, he convicts man of what? 3:23? Of sin. So that's where he starts. Okay? Grace as justification by the blood of Christ through faith. All right? Through faith. That is the system that God has imposed, has introduced, by which we can be made what? Justified. Righteous and cleansed. Grace gives victory over sin. Chapter 6, beginning in chapter 6, going through the end of chapter 8. Now, does this system of grace that God has introduced, does that make sin irrelevant? No, absolutely not. What's going to be the issue there? Primarily, he's going to be focusing on at the Gentiles about this system of grace who came from the mindset of paganism. What's their idea going to be? Why? Because grace will cover it. Does Paul not make the point that grace will cover all sin? Sure he does. But that doesn't mean that sin now is irrelevant and that what you do, your personal conduct, your behavior, it doesn't matter. Absolutely it matters. And Paul's going to be making that point in this section. Grace doesn't mean that the law is bad. Paul's going to spend a lot of time in this section as well. What has Paul said about the law? Just in general. It can't save you. And as a matter of fact, what does it do? It condemns us. It convicts us of sin. If there were no law, what? There'd be no sin. Sin and the knowledge of law, it brings about sin because we are humans and we transgress it. All right? But the law's not bad. As a matter of fact, the law serves a valuable purpose in the life of man. What does it do? Okay, it does. It tells us about the nature of God. It also tells us about the nature of who? Of man. I'm sorry? Absolutely. It talks to us about our nature. And Paul is going to spend a lot of time in that section talking about the nature of man and this dual battle that he's going to be dealing with and talking about between the spirit of man and the humanity of man. All right? So, the struggle. Section 5, we'll go chapter 9 through 11, through the end of chapter 11. Here he's talking about the ethnic Israel versus the spiritual Israel. Okay, it's a furtherance of what he's talked about. Israel's choice. Israel, as a nation, made a choice. And their choice, especially revealed at the time of Christ, was a choice of what? A choice of law-keeping. That was a choice that they made. But what was that not? Even though the Jews chose a system in their own minds, thinking they were justifying themselves before God, that system was what? Not. It wasn't sufficient, and it was never intended to make one right before God. All right? God's system of grace, man's salvation through grace, has been his plan from the very, very beginning. And Paul's going to make that point as well. All right? Then right before he gives his sentiments to the brethren there, he talks about the sanctified life. What is Paul going to be talking about when he describes or speaks of the sanctified life? Paul's talking about all, in the first part of the book, up until chapter 12, he's talking about doctrinal matters. He waits until this point in his letter to do what? Make the application. What does it look like in the life of a Christian? How does it impact you? How is your life changed? A life which is saved by the grace of God requires what? It requires obedience. It requires transformation. It requires one to submit to the authority of God. All right? And then he talks about a very important part of his letter. He's going to make distinctions and make some very clear applications about what topic? The level of what? put it right there, Christian liberty and matters of opinion. That's going to be based on what? A discussion of, that Paul's going to make about to the New Testament church there about what? How they deal with one another when we have varying levels of what? Understanding, faith, conviction. We're not all on the same plane. But I want us to be very clear. When Paul's talking here about people who have different understandings of these concepts of liberty, what is he still referring to them as? Christians, brethren. He speaks to them and introduces this exhortation to them as brethren. They're all brethren. And he talks about dealing with one another with a spirit of understanding and patience and kindness and love. He wants these brethren, these Jews and Gentiles, to know that there's something above these matters. It transcends their level of faith that binds them together as one people. And he wants them to know that and to deal with one another with this spirit of understanding. All right? Whoops. And then, of course, the last part is his personal exhortations to the brethren there. Does he know anybody there in the church at Rome? Oh, yeah. He knows lots of people. All right. He knows a lot of people. And then he's going to reflect on them, reflect on his experience with them. He's going to greet them. He's going to request for their prayers. And he's going to finish his letter with what? One final what? A warning. He's going to warn them. He's going to warn them about what he's been talking about this whole time. All right? He's going to warn about those people who will misuse for their own personal gain. All right? Or for whatever motive they might have. All right? So that's kind of a general overview which will kind of guide us in these segments as we go through it. Does anybody have anything to kind of add to what we're... Yes, sir, Brother John. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. Good point. All right. If nothing else, then let's go to the part of the text that where we talked about we were going to make do some... Oh, I'm sorry, Justin. I think you make a very, very good point. Very good point. And I think that needs to be something that we all go in and enter this study with an open mind, not preconceived notions, as Justin said, because if we'll just do and apply and try to understand what Paul's getting at, I think we will understand and have a healthy appreciation for how grace is the plan, God's plan, and how man can be justified before God, and what the role of obedience is, and faith. Absolutely. So let's enter it, like Justin says, including the teacher, who is not so much a teacher, but more a facilitator. That's kind of what I would consider my role, is a facilitator. And let's discuss, and let's get the true joy out of the book, because it's a liberating book. It's a book that frees one from a life that's condemned on our own basis, on our own ability. It is a book that says you stand before your Creator condemned, but you're not lost. There's hope. There's a plan. And so let's listen to Paul as he unveils this magnificent plan of salvation that Paul writes. Thank you very much. I appreciate those comments. And we want vigorous debate and discussion. I say debate, discussion, and input. Thank you. Yes, sir.
John, if I just make a quick point, you talk about the end here, this unity, this love, this tolerance of different levels. You have to make it, if I could just quickly share this to make a relevance here. Mm-hmm. A week ago, David and I met with a preacher from Africa. You've been to Rhodesia where we grew up. They have a situation right now where these preachers, the Mandels, they worship in congregations in Rhodesia where the community, the cultural community, is so divided politically. Some of the brethren pray that God will continue to bless their marvelous leader, Robert Mugabe. And other brethren will open with a prayer saying, please bless our wonderful leader. And other brethren get up and pray, please Lord, could you take this demon out of our country? Now they say it's crazy. They sit there as preachers. They don't know how to contend with them. But these brethren love each other. My point being, to try and understand that Paul is uniting for the first time Jews and Gentiles. And to try and understand the cultural differences of these people with Paul and the power of Jesus, the challenge that Paul faced to bring these people together, say, tolerate one another, love one another. You know, we're all Americans, right? I mean, we're from another country, but we're all Americans. Mm-hmm. These people were dealing with Americans and Germans or Americans. You know, I'm just saying the diversity that Paul was bringing together, mm-hmm. we just kind of don't really realize the full impact of how powerful Jesus must have been to unite these two different cultures in this new grace.
Very well said. Very well said. And he, and if we can get to it today, he's going to make that point about his role, his purpose, about dealing with the Jews and the Gentiles and the Greeks and the barbarians. All right? So let's see if we can get there to it. Thank you very much for the comment. All right. The book of Romans is said to be summed up in the form of two questions. I thought this was very intriguing. As I was doing some of my study, I was looking at different terms in Vines' dictionary. And he said this in regards to the two questions that Paul is answering here. The first one is, how can the unrighteous man be saved? And if you had to sum it up in one sentence, what does Paul say?
Through grace through Christ.
All right, exactly. Thank you very much, brother. That was my point. By grace through faith in Christ. How can one be saved? By grace through faith in Christ. The second question is like it. How can a righteous man remain saved? Once he's introduced the subject of how one can become righteous before God, he then spends the rest of his letter answering the question, how can one remain righteous before God? And what's the answer to that one? By grace through faith. That's exactly right. That's the core essence of what Paul is getting at. And I kind of thought, looking at it in those two questions, he gives the same answer. This answer of grace through faith in Jesus Christ is going to be the summation of if you could just put it in a phrase, what is he talking about? That's it. All right, so let me ask you to read this. You know who William Tinsdale is. Correct? He was burned at the stake in 1536 for translating the New Testament gospel into English. And in his introduction of his translation, he says, "First of all, we must mark diligently the name of speaking." He's talking about the book of Paul here. "We must mark diligently the name of speaking of the apostle, and above all things know what Paul meaneth by these words: the law, sin, grace, faith, righteousness, flesh, spirit, and such like. Or else, read thou it never so often, thou shalt but lose thy labor." What does he mean? You don't know what Paul is referring to in these by these terms. And again, law, as we'll see, sometimes means different things. But if you don't know what he means, well, then you're not going to ever grasp the beauty and the understanding of the book of Romans. It requires not only knowledge, but a working knowledge, so that when you read these words, and sometimes you'll hit one word, and then another word, and another word, all in the same sentence, you have to know how they interrelate and what he means by them. And so that's kind of what we thought we'd do. We talked about it. We start off with defining these terms. So let's not spend a lot of time here, but let's define it, okay? What is the definition of sin? Transgression of the law, all right? A violation, all right? What is the definition of law? Or, in some cases, with the article the law. Okay. When Paul refers to the law, and a lot of times, remember, that is inserted by the transcribers, but not in the original, but when he's referring to the law, he's referring to the Mosaic system. But sometimes, and it's usually the most often, Paul is referring to law as what? Yeah, as just standards. Okay? List of do's and don'ts. A standard of measurement, a standard of authority. Okay? Just in general. And I think Paul uses it more so there throughout the book of Romans than he does in referring to the Ten Commandments. Jim, you had a comment, and then we'll come to you.
Some places the law of God and law of Moses are interchangeable. Is there a situation here when you see one it's the same as the other?
You're referring to the law of God? Sure, I would expect there to be, if you're specifically referring to the law of Moses, then you're specifically referring to the system of the nation of Israel, the Jews, the cultural law system that they operated and lived by. But the law of God transcends that, does it not? Is the law of God limited to the commandments of the Mosaic system? No, absolutely not. All right, and I think we'll see that through this passage. All right, Kyle, and then we'll come to you.
I was just curious if there's a clear way to delineate between the two, like for reading the passage.
Context. The only way I know is context. Unless it's specifically mentioned, which it's not, usually you just refer, it's an inference, or the context is what determines how you view it. And there's a lot of debate as you go through the whole book as to what he's referring to. All right?
That seems like a pivotal point for a lot of misunderstandings about what Romans talks about.
I don't think so. Because either way, what's the point that Paul makes? Even if you looked at it from the Mosaic system, when he's referring to it, what's the point he's making? It's not a system of justification. Either way, it never was for the Jews, even though they thought it was. So I don't think it's really, and maybe so, we may get to it to where it really throws us for a loop, but I don't think so, at least initially from this perspective that I've looked at it. Go ahead. Paul? And Christ he delineates that, does he not? And what does he say about these bound practices of the Pharisees?
They weren't of God.
They weren't of God. You bind them as if they're from God, but they're not. All right? And not only do you bind them, you don't even keep them. So he makes it very clear, I think, in that certainly, even their extension and application did not change anything in regard to how the law was applied. And I don't think it'll make any difference, in, like I was speaking about in regards to Kyle, how we understand the point that Paul is getting at, what he's trying to make. All right? Didn't mean to do that. Justification. What's the term? All right? Go ahead now. Okay. Justification. Being free from the guilt of law-breaking, being innocent. We talked about that on Wednesday night when we talked about standing in a jury, standing before a jury charged with a crime. The jury says you are just or justified. You're innocent of what you have been accused of doing. Now, we talked about the fact that we in and of ourselves are not justified on our own merit, but God's plan of salvation is a plan which makes us justified. We stand innocent before God. Because of whom? Because of Christ, who bore the burden of guilt that comes with the violation of law. An absolutely glorious principle that Paul talks about here and explains in the book of Romans. So justification, think about it, free of guilt, innocent of law-breaking. Grace. All right. Grace. What is grace?
Unmerited favor. Substance of things hoped for.
All right. Grace is the substance, the reality of things hoped for. I'll let Paul go and finish that in just a second. But in regards to what Paul is talking about, when he says grace, when he says that man is saved by the grace of God, how are we to think about this concept?
We don't deserve it.
Okay.
We don't deserve it. We're getting it anyway.
All right. Something that we're getting that we're not worthy of deserving. All right. So here's kind of what I came up with. And you can turn over to Romans chapter 3, look in verse 24. Also, chapter 5, Paul gives a very lengthy explanation, we'll get there, about grace. Frees one of the guilt of violating the law without compromising God's demand that there be a penalty paid. God says where there is transgression, what? There's penalty. The transgressor is the one who's worthy and deserving of the penalty. But the point of grace, salvation through grace, is that God's righteousness for the penalty of sin is paid not by the offender, but by the Son of God. It is God's explanation in one word that man can be redeemed. The penalty of sin has been paid, and that we receive the righteousness of God. That's kind of what grace is. Look, Romans chapter 3, verse 24. For all have sinned, in verse 23, and fallen short of the glory of God. All have sinned, and all are worthy of what? Death. But being justified as a gift by His grace through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus. That's what grace is. It's man's redemption. And it's, what's the price? What's the price of it? Whose? Christ's blood. It's rendered to us how? Okay, through faith, but free. It's free. He's given it to us. When I say it's free, and when Paul talks about it being free, what is he saying by that? You can't pay for this. You can't earn this. This isn't something that's going to be given to you because all of a sudden now you have reached the point when you can stand before God and I am now justified and worthy of it. You can't. You won't. And he makes the point very clear. Grace is the free gift of God, given without cost. All right? So, let's finish quickly. Faith, what is this? What did I do? Oh. Faith, what is it? Here you go. There's your passage you were looking for. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. All right? Now, that's the definition. When Paul's talking about it in the context of Romans, thinking of that definition of Hebrews and applying it, really, really is kind of difficult to do, right? So what does he mean when he talks about faith? Just in general terms.
Belief in Christ.
Belief. Trust. Conviction. That's what he's talking about. When he says to the one who believes or to the one who has faith, he's talking about one who is convicted and who's got confidence in, who trusts, utterly trusts, wholeheartedly trusts. So when you read faith in this text, I want you to think. Don't try to apply Romans 11:1 to it. Think of this, trust. Yes, somebody raised a hand. Yes. No, actually, Paul's going to pretty much do it for it. So.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think sometimes when people refer to faith, and even some, you know, non-Christians, when they think about faith, they think of it as a blind faith or almost faith. That faith is a belief in something without evidence. And I think that it's just the opposite. I think, yes, faith requires a certain amount of hope and belief on our part, but I do think that it's a belief in something that we have evidence for. We know what it is, and we know that.
Sure. Paul's going to explain to us what faith is. He's absolutely going to make it very clear. And not just Paul, but there are other places we can go which will describe what faith looks like. All right? As a matter of fact, the next term we come to is obedience. What does obedience mean? Okay. It's the result of faith. Here are the text.
Jeremy.
All right. Here's how Bynes described it. Hupo means under. Akuo means to hear. What's the idea here? Under to hear. You're on it. What? Say it loudly. To subject yourself to the voice of another, to the authority of another. Obedience. to submit or obey under the subjection of another. Obedience and faith. We're going to be spending a lot of time about how they work. Listen, I went back into Vines here, how he described it. Faith is of the heart. It's invisible. You cannot see faith. But obedience is of the conduct. It's observable. You can see it. When one obeys under the authority of God, he gives the only possible evidence that he has faith. What is it? It's to obey. That's important that we understand. They are different concepts, but they are related. They are interrelated. Very importantly. I know we're out of time, right? All right. The other term is righteousness. I'm just going to hit it. We don't have time to start here. We're going to have to start in the text, which we should have already been through the first seven verses here. So you see why I don't give you an outline? It would be meaningless. Absolutely meaningless. All right. At this rate, we haven't even gotten into the book. We're already, what, six lessons in? All right. I do apologize for that, but I just don't realize how long it's going to take to get through stuff. Plus Isaac, he talked to me. We'll blame him. All right, thank you.